Gospel of John, the 20th chapter. I've been using this text as a beginning point for a study in the last couple of Sundays on the subject of the Gospel's argument for the existence of God. And we've thus far in our study have talked about the fact that the Gospels do make an argument that God exists. They in many ways assume the existence of God, but they do set forth an argument that Jesus is God. And if they do sufficiently prove that Jesus is God, that He is divine, then they have in fact proved the existence of God. And I think we see this borne out in John's Gospel. It's representative, I think, of what could be said of all the Gospels. But in John 20, verse 30 and 31, we've noted that John makes a statement about the recording as he has provided it, the recording of the miracles that Jesus had performed, and then says in verse 31 that those had been written that you might believe that He is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in His name. John just simply says that the writing of this gospel account was in order to make the case that Jesus is the Son of God, and that believing in that, then one could have life in the name of Jesus. That's kind of the premise that we have set forth as in our study. That if we can sufficiently prove Jesus is God, then we have proved that God does indeed exist. And in our last lesson, on last Sunday morning, we talked about the fact that it is certainly not inappropriate to look for proofs, that the Bible, in fact, offers proofs. We looked at scriptures that talked about Jesus offering many proofs that He was indeed the resurrected Jesus, and that the Scriptures urge us to prove all things and to hold on to that which is good. And so it is in no way a lack of faith to ask for and to look for proof that Jesus is indeed who He claims to be, and that is the Son of God. Well, today I want to talk to you as we continue our study. I want to talk to you about examining the crucial proof. Jesus did, in fact, make many or provide many proofs that He is the Son of God. The miracles, for instance, that John refers to were an indication that He is the Son of God. That they are the basis, John says, upon which his argument is set forth, that one might come to believe that He is the Christ, the Son of God. The Apostle Paul makes, I think, an interesting statement in Romans, the 4th chapter, the 17th verse, when he's talking about Abraham and Abraham's faith in God. And in the latter part of that 17th verse, he makes a statement about God and about two characteristic traits of God. He says in that latter part of verse 17, he says that God is one who can be demonstrated to be God because of He makes the dead alive. And then secondarily, he makes the statement that God also can prophesy. He can predict things. He can bring to existence or speak of things as that don't exist as if they do exist. Two attributes of God, Paul sets out. His ability to make the dead alive, His ability to prophesy or to predict the future. Well, Jesus did both of those things in the course of His life. The raising of Lazarus, for instance, was John the 11th chapter, was one of those miraculous indications that John records, that Jesus demonstrated His power over death. But Jesus also spoke about many things prior to their happening. He prophesied about many things. He predicted His own death in Matthew, the 16th chapter. You recall that He began at that point to talk to his disciples about going into Jerusalem, and there he would suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priest, and he would be killed, and then 3 days later he would rise again. He predicted his own death. He predicted the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in Matthew, the 24th chapter. The entirety of that chapter is about the destruction of that city, which came to pass some 40 years after Jesus spoke those words. And there are many other ways in which Jesus demonstrated his ability to prophesy things, thus demonstrating he had those two characteristics that Paul attributed to God. Many proofs, but there is one crucial proof that is set forth in the Scriptures that is a demonstration that Jesus is, in fact, God. And I think we see this referred to by the Apostle Paul again over in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in verses 3 and 4, where he says, I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that, and I want you to notice the three things that he says. Here's what I delivered that I received that's of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. Three certainties, three things Paul says that can be affirmed as truth about Jesus, that he died, that he was buried, and that he was raised. And what the Scriptures do is they set forth these truths, these certainties about Jesus as proof, as the crucial proof that he is indeed God. The first certainty, Christ died. There really is no dispute about that, that Jesus of Nazareth died. The Gospels really leave no room for debate or for doubt or dispute or denial of this fact. John chapter 19 and verse 33, for instance, we see that this was the assessment of the Roman soldiers who stood by at the crucifixion of Jesus. John 19 and verse 33. Says that coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. The breaking of the legs, I think the Latin term that they used was crucifragium. It was a fracturing of the legs at the crucifixion in order to hasten the death of the person being crucified. With the legs broken, they could no longer support their weight. And so they could only hang then on the cross. They couldn't raise themselves up and get a breath of air. And essentially what the breaking of the legs did was it led to the suffocation of the victim, who could no longer do anything but hang there and not take in a breath of air. When these soldiers who had this duty, which they performed on the two individuals that Jesus was crucified with, when they came to Jesus, seeing that he was dead, they did not break his legs. There was no doubt, no dispute, no denial on the part of these soldiers. Nor do we see that there was any doubt regarding medical evidence. Verses 34 and 35 of that same text go on to describe that what one soldier did do was to thrust his spear into the side of Jesus in verse 34. And then the text says that immediately there came out blood and water. So there's a lot of discussion about the significance of this, of blood and water coming forth after this action was taken. There are, I think, generally speaking, a couple of positions that medical people who are interested in this will take on this subject. One group says that this is an indication that the heart of Jesus was pierced, and that the fluid from the pericardial sac flowed out of the wound. Others say that the blood, this is an indication that the blood and fluids had built up in the chest cavity of Jesus, and that once his side was pierced, they flowed out. I'm not sure that it really matters either way, because what both positions of physicians take in this matter is that the flowing of forth of the blood and the fluids, the blood and the water, that it both indicated, whether it was the heart being pierced or just the chest cavity being open, in either case, blood and water flowing out was an indication of death, that physical death had occurred. Doubt, I think, also can be removed or eliminated by the fact that Jesus' death was not only assessed by the soldiers, it was not only indicated by the medical evidence that that occurred, but it is also a fact that was confirmed by Pilate. Mark chapter 15 and verses 39 through 45, I think is a kind of an interesting insight into these affairs. Pilate, of course, had given the approval for Jesus' crucifixion, and he was thus, after that approval, taken out and put upon the cross. And in Mark chapter 14, well, it would help if I turned to Mark. And it's Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15, and in verse 39, we're told that when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." And there were also some women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. As you look on down in these verses, dropping down to around verse 44, we're told that Pilate, that the message was brought to him that Jesus was dead when Joseph of Arimathea came and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate, verse 44 says, wondered if he was dead by this time. And summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. And what this is indicating to us is that Pilate was surprised when Joseph came asking for the body of Jesus. He received this word that Jesus was dead. It was only 6 hours after Jesus had been put upon the cross, which was an extremely brief amount of time. Historical records indicate that it usually took somewhere between 36 to 72 hours for a person to die hanging on the cross. And so now after 6 hours, here comes the request for the body of Jesus. Pilate is surprised. So what does he do? He confirms that Jesus is dead. He calls in the centurion. He calls in the people who were there witnessing the event and gets from them the assurance, yes, he's dead. Thereupon, Pilate gives the approval for the body of Jesus to be taken by Joseph of Arimathea. And then finally, I think there is a further investigation of the body of Jesus to confirm that he was dead by the people, these witnesses, these firsthand witnesses that were there to take his body off of the cross. They're continuing in Mark 15. Verse 46 says that Joseph bought a linen sheet, took him down, wrapped him in the linen sheet, laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of in the rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene, the mother, and Mary, the mother of Joseph, were looking on to see where he was laid. Those people prepared the body of Jesus, and they detected no sign of life. In fact, as Mark writes this, he uses the word Potome, which literally means dead body. It's an entirely different word than would have been used. The word soma would have been used to refer to one's body, a living body. The point is that these firsthand witnesses all testify to the fact of what Paul affirms there in 1 Corinthians 15, Jesus died. There's really no dispute of that. But then we see that Paul also declared that he was buried. That was the second certainty. He was buried. And there's some things we know about Jesus' burial. For instance, we know who made the arrangements. We've read Joseph of Arimathea. Nicodemus also was involved in making the arrangements. Matthew 27 and verse 57 gives an indication of this. Joseph was no just mere nobody in the eyes of Jewish people. He was a member of the high court, the high council. Luke 27 and verse 50 identifies him as such. But we also know not only who made the arrangements, but we also know how the body was prepared. Going back to Matthew 27 and verse 59, was as we've just read, Joseph bought a linen sheet, wrapped the body of Jesus. It would be almost in what we might describe as being a mummy style of wrapping a body. Myrrh and aloe and spices of 100 weight were added to the body as it was prepared. John chapter 19 and verse 39 and 40. The Apostle John says that Nicodemus came also, who had first come to him by night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus, bound it in linen, wrapping spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. So we know how he was buried. He was buried according to the customs of the Jews. We know where he was buried. And to this degree, we know that he was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, a new tomb, newly hewn out of solid rock. A tomb in which nobody had ever been placed before. Now, all of those things really are pretty standard when it comes to a burial, according to Jewish custom. What was not standard, what was not typical regarding the burial of Jesus, were the unusual measures that were taken to guarantee that he remained buried. There's never been any burial like this from this standpoint. There's never been anyone buried with the measures taken to make sure that he stayed buried. If you look in the gospel accounts, Matthew 27 and start in verse 62. It says, "Now on the next day, which is the one after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, 'Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I am to rise again. Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples come and steal him away and say to the people, he has risen from the dead. And the last deception will be worse than the first.' Pilate said to them, 'You have a guard, go, make it as secure as you know how.' And they went and made the grave secure, and along with the guard they set a seal on the stone." And we know, as we've read about how Jesus was buried, a stone was rolled over the opening that led into this tomb that was hewn out of rock. So a great stone was rolled over in front of that. A guard was placed around this. A seal, maybe something along the lines of a wax seal, was placed on that stone to make sure that if it was removed, the seal would be broken and it would be obvious that it had been opened. So these are some pretty unusual measures that were taken to make sure that the body of Jesus remained in the tomb. Now, concerning that tomb, The third certainty that the Apostle Paul declares in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is not only that Jesus died, and not only that he was buried and he was put into this tomb, but the third certainty is that the tomb indeed was empty after the third day. He arose, Paul said. He arose from the dead. That was Paul's explanation for the empty tomb. That was the explanation that the Christians offered. That was the explanation that the Jewish officials desired to discredit. You remember we read when they went to Pilate asking for a guard to be put on the tomb? They said, because this man said he would rise again on the third day, let's make sure the tomb remains occupied lest his disciples come and steal the body, and then the deception becomes even worse. And they will go around saying, well, he arose from the dead. That is indeed what the disciples said. But what the Jewish officials wanted to prevent from being affirmed was that a resurrection had occurred. Well, the tomb is empty. You know, that is not disputed. Not even by the most ardent enemies of Jesus is it disputed that the tomb was empty. When the apostles, for instance, began to preach, just like the Jewish officials were concerned might happen, when they began to preach that Jesus had been raised from the dead, that the resurrection of Jesus had indeed occurred, if that was a deception, as these Jewish officials said it would be, if that was a deception, how would you prove that? Well, the easiest way would be to go to the tomb, open it up, and to show the body. Then there's no question that this was indeed a deception. They could not do that, however, because, as we've noted, the tomb was empty. They didn't dispute that the tomb was empty. They didn't say when the apostles began to preach the resurrection, hey, guys, we can take you right down here to the tomb and show the body. They didn't say that because they knew they couldn't do that, because the tomb was indisputably empty. The question is not whether or not the tomb of Jesus was empty. The question is, why was it empty? You know, it's interesting that no first century Jewish writer has claimed that the tomb that held Jesus' body was actually still occupied. No first century Jewish critic of Jesus said he's still there. What they did say was exactly what we see these officials in Matthew 27 saying, and that is that his body was stolen. Look, if you would, in Matthew, the 28th chapter, verses 11 through 15. It says, now while they were on their way, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priest all that had happened. Now, these are the guards who had been posted around the tomb. And they wake up in the morning, not really waking up even. In the morning, they discover that the grave is indeed empty. And so they go into the city and they report this to the officials. And when they had assembled with the elders and counseled together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, you are to say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble. They took the money and did as they had been instructed. And this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day, Matthew says, as he writes these things. So here's the story, here is the explanation that the Jewish officials made for why the tomb was empty. They didn't dispute that it was empty, but they said it was empty because his disciples came and stole the body. Now, just think about that for a minute. How reasonable is that? Well, I would suggest to you it's not very reasonable for a few reasons. Number one is because the disciples really were in no mood to steal the body of Jesus. Mark chapter 14 and verse 50 says that at the time that Jesus had been arrested and he was to be crucified, that they, referring to his disciples, they left him and fled. When you come to John chapter 20 and in verse 19, you find that the text tells us that the disciples were still in hiding. They were hiding, John says, out of fear of the Jews. These were not men who were of a mindset, okay, we've got to go steal the body. Their thinking was, we need to protect ourselves. We need to hide. We need to conceal our location from these officials. Another problem with this idea that Jesus' body was stolen is that if the guards were asleep, as they were paid to say, if they were indeed asleep, how would they know who stole the body? How would they know who committed the crime? How could the thieves come, break the seal on that tomb, roll away a stone that weighed several hundred pounds, and not wake up the guard who were paid to say they were asleep when this theft occurred? I mean, these were men who were put at this post for one purpose only, to make sure the body didn't get stolen. How likely is it to believe that they were unable to perform that one task? And then there is the preaching of the apostles to consider. How likely would it be that these men would go out preaching that Jesus had been raised from the dead, which was, in fact, a lie, that they had really conspired and stolen the body of Jesus. But they go out preaching the message that he's been raised from the dead, and they do so at the risk of their own lives. How likely is it that a man would sacrifice his life knowingly for a lie? I know there are a lot of folks that sacrifice their lives for something that's untrue. But they don't know it to be untrue. They're deceived. They think it's true. They are willing to give their lives for it. But that's a different situation from one who knows a thing to be untrue, who knows it's a lie, who in fact perpetrates the lie and does so willingly at the expense of their own life. Just not very likely to happen. In fact, this continued, as we see, as we've read in the Gospels, this explanation of the Jews for why the tomb was empty had legs. I mean, it went on for a long time. It carried on for a long time. Even beyond the time of Matthew, there's some writings from the 2nd century A.D. that record Jewish critics of Christianity still saying the tomb was empty because the body was stolen. This is out well into the 2nd century. But we all know that people don't always have to have rational explanations for things that they want to believe, or rational disproofs for things that they don't want to believe. The Christian's explanation for why the tomb was empty was far different from the Jewish explanation. The Christian's explanation was, as Paul affirmed it there in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 4, He was raised from the dead. And in being raised from the dead, there was demonstrated once again in the life of Jesus that characteristic of God, that He has the power over death, that He can give life where death has been. The question that you and I have to settle, and that every person has to settle in their own minds, is just this. What does the evidence show? We have one more lesson in this series. Next Sunday we'll talk a little bit more about some of the additional explanations that are given as to why Jesus' tomb was empty. But you have to judge, if you have not already done so. You'll have to judge. You'll have to give a conclusion, a verdict, if you will, based upon proofs of why the tomb was empty. Was it stolen, or did He arise from the dead? If He arose from the dead, then how does that impact the question of whether or not Jesus is God? If it proves, as the Bible contends it does, that Jesus is God, then God is. And you and I must confront that simple truth. If it is proved that God is, how is that going to affect your life? Will it affect your life at all? Will you have any sense of obligation, of responsibility, of duty to God, and finding out what He wants from you? If you're not a Christian, you need to resolve those questions in your mind. And if you come to that conclusion that God is and that Jesus is His Son, then the things that they have to say have a great importance in your life. Jesus told men and women who believed, who came to the conviction that He is the Son of God, that to be made right with God, they must confess their faith in Him. They must repent of their sins. They must be baptized, washing the guilt of their sins away. And thereby, they would have made themselves right with God, who is, and who is proven to be. Are you subject to His invitation to come to Him today? Won't you come while we stand and sing?